comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful, beautiful island in space called Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Welcome to talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, the show where you actually matter. Don't forget, if you have not subscribe to the K-Files. Be sure you do. I know some of you say, well, you know, gee, you say that every night, you know. Well, I know, but, you know, a whole lot of people that are hearing me say that and they're responding by saying, gee, he says that every night. A whole bunch of them have not yet subscribed. Could it be you? There's no genius in being in the dark. It's absolutely free, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. You know, the Kevin Smith Show audience is worldwide. You can go on my website and you can click a link up there in the upper right-hand corner and see the top 75 of the countries. They're ranked in terms of, you know, where we're getting the largest audience from. And not only is it worldwide, it's also very diverse. It's not monolithic in view on any topic. It's not a monolithic audience in terms of opinions or beliefs. Very, very diverse. Now, when it comes to the question of the origins of the human race, you know, at that point, you really are dealing with belief more than you're dealing with knowledge. I mean, nobody was there to see it, and nobody's been able to duplicate it in a laboratory. And so we're dealing with belief more than we're dealing with knowledge. And that's okay. There are some things upon which we have to proceed in that way. Now, we have bits of evidence in the form of fossils and ancient artifacts. And you have one group that will look at that evidence, and they will determine that evidence indicates to them that evolution is what happened. You have another group that looks at it. They look at the same artifacts, they look at the same fossils, and they say, well, this indicates to us that God created all of this. And then you have another group that will look at it and say, this doesn't indicate anything at all. There's no way to make any sense out of it. Everyone is just spouting personal beliefs. Well, my guest this evening has rocked the scientific world with the publication of his book called Forbidden Archaeology. And in this book, he puts forth the theory not of human evolution, but of human devolution. My guest this evening is Michael Cremo, and he'll join us here online on the other side of the upcoming break. And we are going to talk about this theory of human devolution as opposed to human evolution. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. As I stated, my guest this evening is Michael Cremo. This is not his first time to be with us on the Kevin Smith Show, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us. And it's my pleasure to be able to say to Michael, welcome back to the show, Michael. We're delighted to have you.
Oh, it's great, Kevin, to be on the show with all your listeners.
Michael, at the top of the show, I talked about how your book, 914 pages, and it's called Forbidden Archaeology, really sent shockwaves through the scientific community. And I was amused this afternoon. I went online and started reading what different people had written, their opinions about the book and so forth. You know, it's polarized. There's nobody in the middle.
People either... Right. You're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, they either absolutely love this book, or they have determined that this book is heresy. And, you know, it's and I read one guy, his review by the name of Tarzia, Wade Tarzia, he tries to detail why he, and he does, he details why he thinks this book is all wet. And yet, one of the key factors in his complaint, one of the key deals, is that he says that you use sources that are outdated. They are 19th century and 20th century. Now, what's interesting about this is Tarzia has a PhD after his name. And I'm not picking on Tarzia, but, I mean, you know, he put it on the internet, so, you know, it's up for grabs, too. He's got a PhD after his name. That means if that's an earned doctorate, which I would assume it is, that means that he earned that doctorate based on studying the very sources that he's now criticizing, because we're only barely into the 20th century, 21st century. So he would have read those 20th century sources as well, or should have. And I just found that almost comical, because, you know, everything that is in science today is built on what was in science last year and what was in science a decade before. There have been some advances, but it's all built on that foundation, the very foundation he attacks. Do you find that just a little bit absurd?
Well, actually, I did, Kevin, and here's a fact. You know, if you look in any of the standard textbooks of archaeology, you know, the ones that are used in the university classrooms, they include discoveries from the 19th century and the early 20th century. For example, they include the Java Man discoveries, which were made in 1893. They include the first discovery of the Neanderthals, which were made in 1859. They include the first discoveries of Australopithecus, which were made in the 1920s. You know, if you look in any standard textbook of human origins or anthropology or archaeology, you will see that they contain scientific reports from the 19th century, the early 20th century, the late 20th century, and now the early 21st century.
Well, look, one of the really big ones that they all point to is Lucy. You know, this they say that's the earliest human skeleton, and that she was found in Africa. This is Lucy. She's the mother of us all. Well, that was a 20th century discovery.
Sure. Einstein's work was done in the early 20th century. His papers on relativity were published in 1905. The theory of evolution was published by Charles Darwin in 1859. The Newtonian laws of physics were discovered in the 18th century. You know, this idea that any science done before January 1st, the year 2000, is really ridiculous. They only bring these things up. Critics like Wade Tarzia are allergic to older evidence only when it contradicts the theories that they believe are true. If evidence from the early 19th century, the 20th century supports their theories, they have no problem with it. It's only when evidence contradicts their theories that they start bringing up these objections. And, you know, then you'd have to wonder, well, what about the discoveries that are being made today? Are they suddenly going to become untrue? Are they suddenly going to become false in the year 2100? It's the only way to get to the truth then would be to go to the end of time.
Yeah.
And have time stop.
Now time is a very interesting thing, because one's philosophy of time plays a huge, huge role. It's a big factor in one's philosophy of the origins of humankind.
I agree with you.
For Darwin, time is a straight line. And there has to be a very long straight line, and there have to be all of these mutations lined up on that line. And the problem
is more complex.
And the problem with that is, I mean, anyone with eyes that work can look around and see that if evolution ever was true, it still is true. It still would be going on. Okay, where's the group just behind us, and where's the group just ahead of us?
Well, I think you're right about that, Kevin. I believe the Darwinian theory of evolution and much of modern science are in fact based on a linear progressive conception of time that has roots in a particular cosmology that comes out of our tradition. But there are other concepts of time that are cyclical. If we go back in Europe to the time of the Greeks and the Roman philosophers like Plato, Aristotle, and others, they had a cyclical concept of time. Plato and Aristotle both said that civilizations have risen and fallen many times in the history of life on Earth, that things go in cycles. It's not linear and progressive. And I actually accept that myself. I believe that human civilizations have risen and fallen many times. We're not the first here on Earth. And it's not a simple, people like simple explanations of the origin of life or other things. They like a simple evolutionary account based on this linear concept of time, but things may be a little more complicated than that.
A simple explanation is simple to defeat. So here we go. This is no secret. Unless you're brand new to this show, this is not a secret at all. If you're brand new, you've never heard me say this before. But look, folks, Darwin's dead. And Darwinian evolution is dead. And here's a real simple way to determine whether it's true or not true. Out of the millions of pieces of fossils that have been found, has there been found one trans species? Just one that's crossed the species line. It's in transition from, we'll say, a snake to a cat. Have we found a snake cat yet? There are no trans-species fossils. There is no fossil evidence for the one thing that has to happen in order for Darwinian evolution to be true, and that is for one species to cross the line and become another.
Right. I think you're right about that, Kevin. Actually, even many evolutionists realize this problem with the fossil record. For example, Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge had, you know, they wrote a paper about this, a scientific paper. They're prominent evolutionists, and they said it's the big one of the big secrets of paleontology, one of the big secrets of the fossil record that paleontologists, scientists, and evolutionists in general don't like to talk about, is the fact that most species, practically every species that's been recorded in the fossil record, more or less pops into existence and continues unchanged for some time and then disappears with no obvious ancestor and no obvious descendant. They said that is the big secret of paleontology, the study of the fossil record, that they don't like to talk about very much. So they actually had to come up with a theory they called punctuated equilibrium to explain it, namely that to explain this pattern, they'd have to say evolution occurs so quickly in terms of geological time that it's not recorded in the fossil record.
Utter nonsense.
It's kind of interesting. They say it's happening when you look at life today. We don't see one species changing into another. So they say, well, the reason we don't see evolution going on in front of our eyes today is that it's too slow to observe. And then the reason we don't see it in the fossil record is it's going too fast.
Utter nonsense.
it's utter nonsense. Amazing.
All right. Now, you have a view of time that is, the view is cyclical, and this is not something that's new and unique to you. There are many civilizations in the past that, as you mentioned, that was their predominant view of time. But somewhere in there, you have come up with a theory, not of evolution, but devolution or devolution. So explain that to us. What is it, and how did you come to that?
Well, here's how that came about. You know, you mentioned in the first part of the show my book, Forbidden Archaeology, which contains lots of evidence, archaeological evidence, contradicting the current theories of human evolution. Most scientists today believe that humans like us first came into existence about 100,000 years ago, having evolved from more primitive ape-like ancestors. They say before 100,000 years ago, there were no human beings like us. But actually, if you look at the original scientific literature, if you look at the original reports by scientists who have been digging into the earth for the past 150 years or so, you'll see they've made many discoveries reported in the scientific literature of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints going back tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years, right back to the very beginnings of the history of life on Earth. And there's not just a few of these discoveries, there are hundreds of them reported in the scientific literature. So I collected all that evidence together and published it in Forbidden Archaeology. And after people read that book, they began asking me, well, you know, if you've got all of this evidence that contradicts the current theories, evolutionary theories of human origins, then how do you think human beings came about? What's your alternative theory or alternative explanation? So to answer that question, I wrote the book Human Devolution. And in that book, I proposed that before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now, many scientists today will tell us that a human being is simply a combination of the ordinary material elements. That's all we are, a complex organization of molecules. And if you organize those molecules in a sufficiently complex way, you'll get what we call mind and consciousness coming out of that, but only in connection with matter, and only temporarily, because when the matter becomes disorganized, then there's no more mind, no more consciousness. But what I'm proposing in my book, Human Devolution, is that it is not matter that is primary, it is consciousness that is primary. It is consciousness that is always existing. And under certain circumstances, consciousness can become temporarily covered by mind and matter. And those coverings are what we call bodies. So what I'm proposing is that as conscious beings, we did not evolve up from matter. Rather, we have devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness, and now our consciousness is covered by mind and matter. And in that limited state, we undergo various unpleasant experiences like old age, disease, death, things. But the conscious self originally is beyond all of that. It's only when it has devolved into the realm of matter that it is subjected to those kinds of experiences. So that's what I mean by devolution. We didn't evolve up from matter. We've devolved or come down from consciousness or spirit, if you like that word.
Okay. One of the things that I have found very interesting is, and now this is a big debate, but we have a break coming up, so we'll have to get into it when we come back, but Neanderthals, because the genome shows that they're human, but they're not related to us. They're a completely different human. We'll get into that when we come back. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back. My guest is Michael Cremo. Michael, when we went away for break, I was pointing out that the genome of the Neanderthals shows that they're human, but they're not our first cousins, second cousins, third cousins, or tenth cousins. They're a completely different kind of human. That by itself kills Darwinian evolution, I think. Because they have Neanderthal as one of our ancestors.
Well, I think those are some very good ways of looking at this. I don't deny the existence of these various ape men that existed in the past, like the Neanderthals, Homo erectus, Australopithecus. They were certainly there. But human beings like ourselves were existing alongside them. That's what the fossil record actually shows. And the pattern that emerges is not one of evolution of one from the other, but rather coexistence of these different kinds of beings. And another thing I'd like to mention is that I'm very much influenced in my work and in my thinking about these topics by the ancient Vedic teachings of India. And in some of the Sanskrit histories, they describe 400,000 human species that have existed throughout, not just on Earth, but throughout the universe. So I wouldn't be surprised to see evidence for parallel existence of different types of humans, that's something I'd be prepared to accept, more or less along the lines that you're suggesting. So the pattern then would be not one of evolution of one from the other, but rather parallel coexistence of these different creatures. And that's what the fossil record actually shows. If you look at the whole fossil record, one of the problems, I believe, is that in our textbooks, we're not getting a complete picture of the human fossil record. We're just getting a carefully edited and manipulated selection of the evidence that conforms to the theory of evolution. That's what we're getting. But if you actually look at all the fossil evidence that's related to human origins, then you don't get an evolutionary picture. You get a picture of coexistence of humans, Neanderthals, Homo erectus, Australopithecus, and whatever.
You know, in the first half of the 20th century, the evolutionists went to court in the United States because they said, all we want is for this theory to be taught in science class alongside what's already being taught. We just want the students to know that it exists and be able to consider it. Well, of course, creationism was the predominant view at that time, and they won their court case, and so it began to be taught. Now, creationists are saying, we just want our theory to be taught alongside evolution so that the students can make up their own mind. And the evolutionists are fighting against that tooth and nail. Now, I have said over and over, and I'm not going to dwell on this. I've got some more things I need to ask you, but I've said over and over and over, evolution is not science, folks. It is not science. It is a religion. How do you know it's a religion? Well, because they're believing in things for which they have no hard evidence. That's faith. It is religion just as much as Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Taoism, whatever. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't have religion. What I'm saying is you ought to recognize that Darwinism is religion. It's not science. The fact that there are a bunch of guys in lab coats that are part of this religion, that doesn't make it science either. Just because they call themselves scientists and in other ways are scientists, this theory is a religion. Now,
well, it's certainly presented that way.
Well, when you ardently argue for something you can't prove, and you ardently, and that's okay, you can do that. But when you do that, and then you try to tell everyone else that because I've got a PhD and I say it's true, it's true. You know, that's not science. That is that's faith in a belief. And they're trying to shove that down our throats, just as organized religion tried to shove their beliefs down our throats in centuries past.
And well, I think you've got a great point there, Kevin, because, say, there's the case of Galileo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, several centuries ago, he had some different idea about the solar system, but the church at that time had considerable influence over government,
mm-hmm.
and the church used its power to get the government of that time to suppress the views of Galileo, and, you know, it's mentioned in a lot of textbooks as one of the great victories of science over religion. But it's interesting today it is the scientists who have a lot of influence with government, and today the majority of the people who call themselves scientists believe in the theory of evolution. And they use their influence with the government, with the federal courts, with, you know, basically the court system, to get a monopoly in the education system for their mm-hmm. ideas. And I think that's just unhealthy. When they're in the position of power, then they do the exact same thing they criticized the church for doing several centuries ago to Galileo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like the Pope recently gave an apology, you know, for what they did to Galileo, I think someday these scientists who are demanding a monopoly for their ideas and are excluding alternatives are going to eventually apologize for what they've done. And I think the real solution is to let's just say, yeah, a majority of scientists today do support that theory of evolution, all right. But it's also a fact that there are scientists and researchers and others who don't support that theory. So I think the public tax-supported schools give the scientists who support the theory of evolution most of the textbook pages in biology, but there should also be mentioned in the textbooks of biology the alternative views that are held by a minority of scientists today, and then let the students make up their own minds about it. And if that were done, I think gradually over time, you would see the percentages changing, so that in 30 or 40 years, it would be the supporters of the theory of evolution who are in the minority, and those who are supporting what we now call the alternative views, which I believe are the correct views, would be in the majority. But even then, even if the supporters of my ideas and your ideas were in the majority, I think we should also respect the minority, whatever views that they have.
Well, yeah, because none of us were there to see it all happen.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, no matter how good our data may become, it will always have holes in it because we're dealing with vast expanses of time. But do you know what it is that moves me away from thinking that evolution was correct? You know, it was not the Bible. It was a book by a scientist. It was a book by a scientist who was head of the science, College of Science at Edinburgh University. His name was A.E. Wilder Smith. He wrote a book called Man's Origin, Man's Destiny. And in this book, this scientist absolutely destroys Darwinism, scientifically. And after I read that book, and I read that book in the 1980s, but when I read that book, actually, I read that book in 1978, when I read that book, I walked away saying, Darwin is dead. And I recommend it to anybody. All right, now let's get back to something else here about the scientists. Obviously, the material, the data is out there because you filled up 914 pages with it. So the data's out there, but it's not getting to the general population. It's got to be coming through some kind of filter. Somebody has a tea strainer straining out what they think the public doesn't need to know. What's the deal with this knowledge filter?
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that. I was very surprised when I found all these reports for extreme human antiquity in the scientific, what I call the primary scientific literature. By primary scientific literature, I mean the original reports by original investigators published in the professional scientific literature. In that primary scientific literature, you can find many reports of archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, reports that showing that humans like us have existed for millions and millions and millions of years on this planet. The question is, why isn't that in the textbooks? Why can you only find it in books like Forbidden Archaeology? It is because of what I have called, and you've called, a process of knowledge filtration that's going on, whereby the facts that support the dominant theories are passing through that filter, and therefore you'll find them mentioned in textbooks that students study in high school and university. You'll find these facts mentioned by scientists on the television programs you see on PBS and some of the other networks. And when you go to the museum, you'll see these artifacts and discoveries on display. But if you have discoveries, if you have facts that radically contradict the dominant theories, they tend to get filtered out. They tend to be set aside, ignored, forgotten, and therefore you're not going to see them mentioned in the textbooks. You're not going to see scientists talking about them on the National Geographic specials and the NOVA specials. You're not going to see these things in the museum displays, although they may be there somewhere in the back rooms of the museum. So I believe the reason is this knowledge filtering goes on is because of the commitments that many scientists today have to their current theories.
To their religion. Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. My guest this evening, Michael Cremo, the author of the rather earth-shaking book called Forbidden Archaeology. As we went away for break, you said it was because the filter happens because of their commitment to their theories, and I said, because we were out of time, I didn't give you a chance to respond, but I said their religion. And, you know, I'm really hard-nosed about this, and I'm not as diplomatic as you are. You have to be more diplomatic about it. But I'll tell you, these guys that are sold on evolution are intellectual mudsuckers. They're not looking at the evidence. They're buying what Dr. Somebody told them. And if they look at the evidence, if they look at the... Show me one amoeba in history that ever became something other than an amoeba. You know? they don't exist. Trilobites did not become something else. They were here. They were here for a long time, and then they disappeared. And so, you know, people talk about, you know, they found the missing link. There is not the missing link, folks. There are millions of missing links because in order to go from a one-celled creature just to the first little bit of complex life, there are hundreds of thousands of mutations that had to take place. Where are the links?
Oh, I agree with you 100% on that. If they were really going to put this theory of evolution on a really scientific basis, they would have to be able to tell you, well, what was the genetic structure of, say, let's imagine that long, long ago there was some primitive little animal that didn't have an eye, you know, sort of like a worm or something like that. Or legs or anything. Well, how do you go from that to, you know, an animal that has eyes that can see and wings that allow it to fly and all of that? You would have to be able to say, well, here's what the genetic structure of that primitive little animal was, and then here is the first change that would have to be made in the genetic structure of that primitive little animal to give it the first step towards an eye, for example. And then you would have to explain, well, what was the next genetic step, and the next, and the next, and the next, over many, many millions of years, until finally you've got, you know, the animal with a fully developed eye capable of seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You find no such explanation in any scientific textbook or any scientific publication anywhere in the world. You just find just statements that, unsupported statements that, yeah, it evolved. You know, but what does it mean? They can't explain these things, even in the very terms that their own theory actually demands. It's what I would call Darwin fairy tales. Yes, shape-changing animals that it's almost mythology, basically.
Well, you know, the fossil record shows, and I have no problem with this, that there is, if you want to use the word evolution, there's some evolution within species lines.
That's a fact.
We see it today. We see it today. But some of the things they point to, for instance, the evolution of horses, they'll show you these little tiny skeletons that were the proto-horses. And they evolved into what we have today. Well, look, you can go to China and find those little proto-horses running around in China. Some people keep them in their house as pets. You know, that doesn't prove evolution, though. You know, it proves variation within species. But, and there's variation. I'll tell you this. I lived in Serbia. And when I was living in Serbia, I would go sometimes to the capital city, Belgrade. And in Belgrade are some of the tallest women I've ever seen. You see people walking down the street, and husband and wife, it looks like Mutt and Jeff. I mean, you know, she's tall, he's short. Now, it's not everybody, but they've got a very large number of very tall women in Belgrade, more than any city I've ever been in. Okay, well, what accounts for that? You know, I don't know. But I guarantee you they're still human. Guarantee you they're still human.
Well, you can look at dogs, for example. All the dogs in the world belong to the same species, Canis familiaris. And they range from little Chihuahuas up to Great Danes. But they're all members of the same species. Now, just imagine the confusion that could cause in the fossil record. You know, you can find the bones of a Chihuahua, bones of a Great Dane, bones of a Dachshund, bones of a German Shepherd. You would think they were different species, but actually they're all the same species. They're just variations that have come about by breeding over, you know, the past several thousand years. You get this diversity among dogs, and dog breeders know how to manipulate the diversity to get the different traits that they want in their animals. Same with horses, you were mentioning, and a lot of. So yes, I agree with you there. It is possible to get variation within a species, but if you push it too far, either it doesn't work, or you get hybrid animals that will not reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens when you try to push that too far.
All right, now I'm pretty tough on. I'm not, and I want to make this clear because we have a lot of scientists that listen to the show. I'm not against science at all. I'm for it, and I'm not against scientists. I'm against people wearing lab coats, calling themselves scientists, who have bought into the theory of evolution religiously, so that they will not look at the actual evidence, the data, the facts. Now, those are intellectual mudsuckers, and it doesn't matter how they can have so many degrees that they're giving a thermometer a race for its money. It doesn't matter how many doctorates you've got. If your mind is closed and you've bought into this without actually looking at the data. And you might say, well, I've looked at it and I've decided. Okay, that's not good enough. Explain to us why you believe in evolution when you've got great whopping bits of data that say it can't happen and didn't happen, and you have nothing in the fossil record that says it did. Now, look, there's one more thing about this, and then I'm going back to your book, but you may address this in your book. One of the things we hear from the scientific community often is, well, this is settled science, and, you know, this is the great majority of scientists have looked at this and have adopted this theory. You know, that doesn't mean anything. The great majority of scientists one time told us the Earth was flat. You know,
That's right.
It doesn't matter how many people say something, that doesn't make it more true.
Yeah, it's there's one historian of science and philosopher of science named Larry Loudon who pointed out in one of his books that practically every scientific theory that's ever been proposed has later turned out to be wrong. Just a fact, you know. It should. Even Darwin, you know, he suggested, well, yeah, because he believed human beings came from apes, but then he proposed, he said he was sometimes troubled by the fact that if my brain has come from the brain of a monkey, how much faith should I put in the ideas that are coming from my brain, like this theory of evolution that I'm proposing? And I think that's a very healthy attitude to take towards, you know, that. And that was what Darwin himself said about it.
Darwin himself, I mean, you know, he just thought about this and he wrote it down, but Darwin himself doubted his own theory. He didn't disbelieve it, but he had grave doubts about it. And one of the big doubts was caused by the fact that there were no trans-species fossils.
Oh, that's right. He just said that the fossil record was probably the strongest argument against his theory.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it is. It is. So that's
okay, well,
anyways, in that sense, I'm a Darwinist.
Okay, we have to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about if we didn't come from apes, where did we come from? We'll be back.
Arizona, this is the Kevin Smith Show.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us just now in the second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. Wow, that first hour we have really covered some ground with my guest, Michael Cremo. And Michael Cremo, I want to ask you, if we didn't evolve from monkeys, where did we come from?
Well, that's a topic I deal with in my latest published book, Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory. And basically what I propose in that book is that we didn't evolve from apes, we didn't evolve from monkeys, we didn't evolve up from matter, as most scientists now believe. Rather, we've devolved or come down from a level of pure consciousness. Most scientists today, they believe matter is the primary thing. They believe that if matter is organized in a sufficiently complex manner in the brain, then you get what we call consciousness and mind and all of that. What I'm proposing is that it's consciousness that's primary. It's consciousness that is eternal, that has always existed. And it's only under certain circumstances that consciousness becomes covered by matter. So that's basically what I'm proposing. That we
would you say that the material world, and I'm speaking of living things, plants, animals, us, but the material world is all a manifestation of consciousness?
Yes, I believe it's ultimately, it's not that consciousness comes from matter, it's that matter comes from consciousness. There's ultimately a source of all conscious beings, I believe, that is the source of matter. It's not that consciousness is produced by matter. Ultimately, in the ultimate state, we would find that matter is coming, is an energy of an intelligent, conscious being that is the source of everything. That's my conviction, and I think there's a lot of scientific evidence to support this idea that consciousness is primary. Consciousness pre-exists matter. It exists apart from matter. It's independent of matter. There's the evidence, for example, of out-of-body experiences. There have been many medical studies done on this topic, showing that there are times when the conscious self appears to separate from the body and exist completely apart from it. For example, during heart attacks, many people in hospitals who are undergoing heart attack resuscitations report separating from their bodies, and they look down and they see, you know, their bodies. They see the doctors and nurses operating on them. And these kinds of reports have been verified by medical doctors, by physicians who've carefully studied this phenomenon. They have found that what these people report having seen during their out-of-body experiences match what the physicians who were treating them recorded in their detailed medical records. So, you know, you've got various categories of evidence suggesting that consciousness can exist apart from the body, apart from the brain, apart from matter. And if you analyze that evidence, then you have to begin thinking, well, then where does that consciousness originally come from? I believe we exist in a multi-level cosmos. You know, there are different levels of the cosmos. Right now, I would say we're in the level dominated by matter, but that's not our original home. There are higher levels of the cosmos. The topmost level is the level of pure consciousness. And that, I believe, is our original home. That is where we come from. But if we depart from that level, if we enter into the world of matter, then we need vehicles in which to function on this level. You know, for example, as human beings, we're normally meant to exist on the land. If we want to go into an alien element, a foreign element like water, and exist under the water, then we need a vehicle that will allow us to function there. We need a submarine or a diving suit or something like that that will let us function in that world of water, that underwater world. So similarly, when a pure conscious self comes down to this level of reality, the material level of reality, it needs a vehicle made of matter in which to function on this level. And that's what I believe that bodies are. Bodies are vehicles for conscious selves that allow them to function on this level of reality. And those vehicles may be in the human form or the animal form or the plant form or the insect form or the fish form. There are many, many different forms, but all of them are vehicles for conscious selves.
Now, I want to tell you, you may be aware of this, but I want to tell you about a scientist who has proven you're right. His name is Dr. Gerald Epling. And Dr. Epling has been a guest on this show. He is an expert in memory. But in his own experimentation, he has been able to scientifically prove and document, measure it, document it, that plants will respond to our thoughts. Now, we all have heard about those experiments where you play music and the plants respond, or you speak to them and they'll respond. But he's been able to show that they respond to our thoughts. Now, he and I went round and round here on this show because I was pressing forward the idea that proves that plants have consciousness, or there is consciousness about plants. And he was not willing to go that far. But his experiments, look, if it can respond to my thoughts, it's connecting to my consciousness. And that his experiments, in my estimation, absolutely prove that there is consciousness about plants. You don't have to get into the animal kingdom to find consciousness. If it's living, there is consciousness.
Yes, there's also been some experiments by, you know, some scientists with single-cell creatures, you know, amoebas and things like that. And they also appear to respond to thought.
And experiments with human DNA, and it responds.
Oh, that's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And so the mantra that we are what we think, it appears that's pretty much correct.
Yeah, there was one scientist that I met personally and whose work I'm a little bit familiar with, you know, Beverly Rubik. And you know, she had done some investigations with researchers who had were doing experiments with these single-celled creatures, and just by thought alone, they were able to influence, for example, how they responded to different drugs and things like that. And they're scientifically reported experiments. It was really kind of interesting. So, if we take Dr. Epling's.
Uh-huh.
Work and the work of Beverly Rubik, it appears, yeah, that all of these bodies, whether they're single-celled creatures, plants, fish, they're vehicles for conscious cells. It's really pretty amazing.
Tell you what, I want to open the telephone lines and allow our audience to join us. Folks, those of you watching on KSS-TV, the telephone numbers have appeared on your screen. For those of you who are listening via radio or computers or TiVo or cell phones or whatever way you're listening, the main telephone number that comes to this studio is 623-444-5889. Let me give it to you again, 623-444-5889. If you're in the USA or Canada, we have a toll-free number that you can use if you need to call me toll-free. That number is 888-223-4599. Now, and then if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada and you don't want to make that long-distance call, that international long-distance call, you can go to my website. Scroll down, you'll see a link that says flash message, and you can send me a flash message. And I'll read your comments or your question, and we'll discuss them. Let's go to the telephone line. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Phoenix.
Phoenix, Arizona. All right.
Yeah, I've been watching the show on my monitor here. Michael, you're fantastic. I'm a big fan of yours. I'm Jerry Wills from Expeditions TV, friend of Kevin. And you and I have spoken at one time in the past. Since that time, I've found quite a few things. And I have a couple of questions for you, if you don't mind.
Sure. Where was it that we spoke? At one of the conferences I was at?
No. I'm a friend of Marshall Payne, and he put me in touch with you.
Oh, Marshall Payne. Right. Okay.
Yep. Question number one. I've been trying to get to Bolivia, and no one wants to help. Not that I can't get there, but there's an island there with a human footprint on it that's supposed to be several million years old, and I'm just excited to ask you about this because the only piece of evidence that I've found had your name attached to it. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I wrote about that in a column that I write for Atlantis Rising magazine, and this discovery came to my attention about 2 years ago when I was in Hawaii. I was at a conference, and there was a researcher from Bolivia there who mentioned to me that in Bolivia, a very ancient footprint, human footprint, had been discovered in layers of rock that date to the Miocene period, which goes back about at least 5 million years, and perhaps as much as 20 million years. So that's really amazing. Then after that, there were some reports that came out of Bolivia from one of the government agencies. There was a press conference held in the foreign ministry, I think it was, and there were some Bolivian researchers who showed photographs of the footprint and gave some indication that they were found in the shores of Lake Titicaca there. And but I haven't been able to learn anything more since that period of time. So if you are going to Bolivia and you're actually able to track down some of those researchers or visit the locale and get any more information about it, that would really be great.
Well, I've actually, with Kathy, my wife, we've gone back down there twice trying to get to this, and we were kept away by lead researcher, I believe his name was Michael something, and basically he told us that they weren't going to let anyone get to the site, that they were in negotiations with National Geographic, and it was going to keep anyone from getting to the site until after National Geographic broke the story, you know, did their videotaping, because as you might remember, Kathy and I have Expeditions TV, where we go down and try to video document things like this, and they just wouldn't let us in at all. The first time we heard about it, Bolivia had gone into a state of siege, and we were trying to hire a boat to get us to the island. Second time we went down, did get in touch with the lead researcher again, and that's when he told us this information, but we're not opposed to going back down and trying a third time. If you'd like to come with us, you're welcome to join us.
Well, we'll have to be in touch about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think this sometimes does happen in the case of scientific discoveries, that sometimes there is an element of publicity and, you know, attempts to control access and photographs and films and things like that. That often does happen for various reasons. So but I hope you're able to get through somehow and get some verification of this very, very interesting discovery from Bolivia. Many times people ask me, are things like this being discovered at the present time? Because in my book, I'm doing a historical survey of the evidence, so I talk about evidence from earlier periods of time, the 19th century, early 20th century, and some people ask, well, are these discoveries still being made today? And the answer is yes, they are still being made today. And this is one of them, and I think it's one of those cases that deserves serious attention, and I'm really happy that you're looking into it.
Well,
can't do everything myself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're our hero, so you're one of the reasons we wanted to bring it back, so we can bring it forward so people can learn from it. We always refer folks to your book because it's the best thing out there, in our opinion.
Well, thanks a lot, Jerry.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing is, I was wondering if you're familiar with Cajamarca and the aqueduct system up in northern Peru.
That I'm not familiar with. At least the name doesn't immediately bring something to my mind. What's that about?
Well, there is an aqueduct system. Kathy and I were just up there in October. It traverses the Andes. I have forgotten now how many miles. It's quite lengthy. It is carved precisely at such an angle that the declination from this high Andean glacial lake all the way down to Cajamarca, the declination is kept intact. It's one of the first aqueducts ever to be shown to use a hydraulic means of controlling the water flow. And it's just the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen. In one area, it goes completely through a mountain, and it's tunneled through a mountain with such precision that it's just mind-blowing. When we were there, we were wandering through the Andes for several weeks and, you know, trying to track it down, and I had a theory there must be other branches to this, and we did find it, which I don't think has ever been documented. What we discovered was that in several areas, it would go through, let's say, a rocky ridge that would rise several hundred feet, so they would tunnel directly through to maintain that angle of declination. Above it, there would be these large 20-foot by about 5-foot wide rectangular areas down through 20-foot of rock, 30-foot of rock, granite, for skylights. And it would go all the way through this area, maybe a half a mile. And
that's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
And the thing is, Michael, this is something that's so old that there's writing there, but no one can decipher the writing. They can't figure it out. Marshall hasn't been able to figure it out either, so far as I know. And they being conventional archaeologists, are saying that this is attributable perhaps to the Chichipoya or the Wari culture, which I think is ridiculous because the technology to do something like this is just, you know, beyond the scope of a more primitive society. So in relation to your book, of course, the De-Evolution book, I'm wondering, do you suppose that maybe humankind had reached a pinnacle of understanding and something happened and cast everyone back down to the Stone Age again? These are remnants of what they had accomplished.
I think that's true. I think human civilizations have risen and fallen over vast periods of times, many times in the course of the history of life on Earth. I fully accept that idea.
Jerry, I'm sorry, I had your volume cut down, so Jerry, if you'll start again.
No, I was just saying, I figured that was a redundant question given the body of information in your book. But that's all for now. I don't want to tie up the phone lines. It's a real pleasure speaking with you again, Michael, and if you're interested, you can get my phone number from Kevin, and you and I can continue this conversation. We found some things I think you'll be quite interested in.
It does sound very interesting, and yeah, we should stay in contact, sure.
All right, Jerry, thanks for the call. We have a flash message here from Tom over in Australia, and it says, hi, Kevin, every single living thing is a trans species. If you could take 20,000 generations of mothers and daughters, rabbits, and line them up, there would be little change between each mother and daughter. But if you compared the first mother to the last daughter, there would be noticeable changes. Yes, but it would still be a rabbit. And that's the point. It's not trans species. Okie dokie. Caller, are you willing? Well, let's see. I started to say, are you willing to hang on through the break? But we've got time to get started anyway. So if you'll tell us your first name and from where are you calling?
It's Kevin from North Bay, Ontario, and of course I'd be willing to wait through the break.
Yeah.
Hello there, Michael Cremo. Very, very good show tonight, guys. Michael, what researchers and scientists such as Dr. Lloyd Pye, as well as archaeologists and research and scholars like Zechariah Sitchin, have postulated that both evolution and creationism are both right to certain degrees, that something or some intelligence came along and altered the DNA of something that was already here. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I believe that Darwin did have some correct insights. I do think his idea that there's a common ancestor to all the different life forms is a good one, but I don't agree that the common ancestor is a simple amoeba. I believe the common ancestor is the most complex living being at some higher level of reality. As for the idea that human beings like us were produced by some extraterrestrial intervention in the DNA structure of ape men who exist on this planet a few hundred thousand years ago.
And we'll have to keep folks on the edge of their seat to hear that. But that's where we'll pick up when we come back. Both of you guys will stay right where you are, and audience, stay right where you are. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back. We have a question on hold, and that question has to do with alien intervention in our DNA. And you were just about to answer that when the break took over. So, Michael, if you'll pick up there and answer the question, we're all ears.
Well, first of all, I agree with the idea that there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. We're not the only intelligent conscious beings in the universe. And I do also accept the idea that over vast periods of time there's been contact, between conscious intelligent beings in other parts of the universe and conscious intelligent life on this planet. Those are two things I agree with. There's been interaction. As far as the specific idea that that there was some extraterrestrial intervention to manipulate the genome of one of the ape men that existed on this planet and in that way produce human beings on this planet, human beings like us on this planet a few hundred thousand years ago, I really don't accept that idea because as far as I can see, there's evidence that humans like us have been present since the very beginning of the history of life on Earth. Not only life on Earth, but life in the whole universe. Human beings have always been around. So, as I said, I do accept the idea of extraterrestrials. There are extraterrestrial intelligences. I do believe they have visited the Earth and interacted with human beings on the Earth in the past. That's a fact. But the specific idea that you're talking about, I don't actually accept. I have a lot of respect for Lloyd Pye, Zechariah Sitchin. I love both of them. But we might have a little bit of a difference of opinion. And normally, in my talks and in my lectures, I really don't get into criticizing the works and ideas of other authors in the alternative history field. I just let people read whoever they want to read and make up their own minds about it. But in cases like this, where I'm specifically asked a question, I feel like...
Well, but see, it's not criticism. You're not criticizing them to say you have a different opinion.
Yeah, that's how I hope people see it. And as I said, normally I don't get into this sort of thing. I figure people can look at the different researchers and evaluate them and make their own decisions about who they'd like to agree with and or disagree with. That's up to them. But as I said, if I'm asked a direct question, I'm not going to slide away from it or avoid answering the question.
Sure. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Good evening, gentlemen. My name is Elias, and I'm calling from Portland, Maine.
Okay, Elias, welcome aboard. What's on your mind?
I have two questions for the doctor, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was, I'm sort of a recent student of the writings from ancient India, the Vedas and the Mahabharata, and that sort of thing. And I was really intrigued with the depiction of especially during the Mahabharata and some of those stories, that the human nobility in those stories were served by this sort of race of intelligent ape men, or like wild, hairy, sort of like ape men. And there was one that was sort of a hero who went around with one of the main characters from that. And I was wondering if that might be a racial memory of a time when what we would call Homo sapiens existed with another intelligent human race, and if Mr. Cremo, Dr. Cremo, had an opinion about that.
Okay, I'm really glad you brought that up, because many people think that the idea of ape men was invented by European scientists like, you know, Darwin and others in the 19th century. But long before that, thousands of years ago, the authors of these ancient Sanskrit texts from India, like the Mahabharata that you were mentioning, were writing about what we would call ape men. They were called vanaras. They were called forest dwellers. And if you look at the descriptions of them, you'll see that they had bodies not exactly like those of human beings, but those of apes and monkeys. However, on the other hand, they also weren't like ordinary apes and monkeys, in that they had the power of speech, and they had a culture, a simple culture, but still a level of culture that we don't see among, you know, apes and monkeys. So, yes, I think it's very significant that these ancient Sanskrit writings were speaking thousands of years ago about apes and ape men, what we would call ape men, and I think that's very significant, and I'm really glad that you brought it up. And actually, it was those ancient writings were some of the inspiration for the work that I'm doing. And the conclusion I think that can be drawn from those ancient writings is that, yes, ape men were there. They may even still be here at present. That takes us into another area of alternative biological research, you know, the existence of living ape men that go under various names in various parts of the world today, like Sasquatch and Bigfoot and Omnis and so on and so forth. In my book, Forbidden Archaeology, I actually have a chapter about the evidence for living ape men. So the conclusion, I believe, that can be drawn from both the scientific evidence and these ancient writings is one of coexistence of humans like us with various types of ape men in the past, certainly, and perhaps even today.
Excellent. Can I ask one more quick question, Kevin?
Sure.
I don't want to make you hit the button too long there, but I was wondering, I haven't gotten a chance to get my hands on your Human Devolution book, but I was wondering if it's in your opinion, we've come down from consciousness as you described. I was wondering if there was a precipitating event that made us manifest in this sort of physical reality from consciousness. If it was a natural, say, like maybe aspect of the yuga cycles, or whether there was like something that made that happen. And I'll take my answer.
That's the kind of the ultimate question, I believe. And here's how I think about that. Ultimately, we're all conscious selves that originally existed on a level of pure consciousness where we existed in harmony with the source of all conscious beings and with all other conscious beings. Now, why aren't we at that level today? I believe it's because of individual decisions each of us who are now on this level have made. The ruling principle of that level of pure consciousness is love, which is unselfish. If a conscious being becomes selfish or egotistical, it can no longer exist in that harmony, because in that selfish state, one wants to exploit, dominate, control others for his or her own pleasure. And in that state, one cannot exist on that original level of pure consciousness. There has to be some other level of reality in which we can function according to our selfish desires, and that's this material world. And
So you don't see one single precipitating event that brought this about. It was individual choices.
It's individual choices.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. I just want to say I'm kind of a fan of our guest's literature and books. I've read a little bit about him in the past and some of the work, and I don't doubt that he hasn't uncovered things that were 32 million years ago. However, I doubt both propositions, so to speak, on both sides of the table. I think that, going 32 million years back, the Earth was different, and maybe 100 million years if we were here, if the Earth was here, climate was different. If you look at evolution, it's not just, and I'm saying Darwin is dead, but I don't believe evolution is dead. I don't think both sides have proven themselves completely into the reality that a doorknob is a doorknob. And like he's saying, we come up with new discoveries all the time. I'll bring up the fact the lemur. Is the lemur a monkey? Well, it's a primate, but primates are divided into four different categories. The promiscuous monkeys, apes, and lemurs are prosimians or something like that.
Prosimians,
the fact that when you look at the tree, you can see that it's very possible a lemur was from an early ancestor, but it wasn't necessarily connected later to the species. You can go up, and I think you go up the category, and I think there's this huge web. On the other hand, the fact that it says 32 million, we're finding something that's, like a human nowadays and stuff, proves that the Darwinian theory in certain aspects is wrong as well. But I do see trans species. I see amphibians that could have turned in. Let's put it this way. You've got mammals like whales in the water. Well, we're a mammal. I see a connection there. I see a connection that our genetics are partially like a pig and partially like a chimpanzee. There's two squirrels that are on either side of the Grand Canyon. They're different species evolved probably in the last thousands of years, let alone 200 million years, and they can't breed with each other. They're two different, they're two different relatives, because the list goes on and on. So,
well, the problem, though, Bob, is because you can imagine trans species doesn't manufacture that in the fossil record.
That's right, and that's what brings me to the point. This the DNA gets so degraded over time, and evolution happens so much faster on its natural terms with a changing environment that's not like ours nowadays, that I believe that we're very homocentric in our views. I can see it very possible that there could have been genetic engineering, but also to take the fact that there's still some dumb forms of life that are very primitive, like the troglodyte or the grape fish or whatever that is, which is like the single cell, doesn't necessarily mean that it can't be just as complex on the other end. And in the end, my theory, the fact that either side can't prove each other is right, is because there's not enough evidence to prove either one. And that comes from the fact that 99.999% of all the species we've ever seen, we can't find, that went extinct. And the farther back you go to our closer relatives, well, that's when you're going to find less species. I mean, the dinosaurs could have come much later. To believe that a fish that grows a spike on its stomach and starts clawing up the rock isn't an adaptation from an earlier fish, and the fact that that can't start breathing air and turn into something like a lizard is, to me...
Yeah, we have to take a break. It's easy to imagine it. Find it in the fossil record. It's not there. All right, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this. And we are back. We're on Final Approach. We only have a few minutes left. I've got a couple of flash messages that I've been holding. I want to get to those. And remember the key. The key to what we've been talking about is where is it in the fossil record? Look, I am willing to buy evolution. I'm willing. Show me the fossil record where there's a trans species. Just one. I'll accept one as proof. Okay, flash message from Blue in Australia. Blue has two questions. One of them you've already talked about, sort of. What are your thoughts on humans being sort of seeded here on a meteor? That a meteor brought something in that caused humans to start up, and you've already addressed that. Okay, do you think, Mr. Cremo, that we're living in a closed dimensional world and feel truth is beyond our clouds? And real truth is beyond our clouds. What do you think about that?
I think that's a very good idea. I believe, as I said, we're in a multi-level cosmos. We're now finding ourselves in the level that's dominated by matter, although we are originally from a level of pure consciousness. I think it is possible to get glimpses of that level of pure consciousness. It is possible for there to be an evolution of consciousness back to that level. So that's what I believe about that.
All right. Caller, we've put you on hold. If you'll just hang on, we'll get to you right after we take this flash message. Rob in Australia says, Mr. Smith, can you please ask Michael Cremo if Pakal's tomb, the tomb lid can be interpreted as Pakal looking through a telescope? Okay. What do you think?
I actually didn't. There's a little bit of a glitch in the sound coming over, so I didn't actually catch that question.
Okay, Pakal's tomb in the Mayan civilization, Pakal, his tomb on the lid is a carving, and he wants to know if it can be interpreted as Pakal looking through a telescope.
There are some who have interpreted it that way, and I don't have any objection to those who have interpreted it in that way. I think if we look at a lot of the sculptures and carvings on temples and other structures from ancient civilizations, we often see some very amazing things. For example, in ancient temples in India, there are carvings of things that are They resemble spaceships and aircraft. They're, in the Sanskrit literature, they're also described as vimanas. That's a Sanskrit word for what we would call spacecraft or aircraft. So I think, yes, in cases like the one that the person is inquiring about, that it is possible to interpret things in that way. Of course, you have to look carefully and make sure your interpretation is justifiable, but I don't have any objection to things like that.
All right, let's go back to the telephone. This will be our last call for the evening, and we'll have to make it pretty quick because we're just about out of time. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin from Beaverton.
Yes, Kevin.
I was wondering if, Michael, you think that some people have confused adaptation for evolution?
Yes, I think that's a good way to look at it. Of course, every species is adapted to its environment, where we get along in the environments that we find ourselves in. But evolution involves more than that. It involves showing transitions between different types of body forms, showing how wings came about when there were no wings, how eyes came about when there were no eyes, and that's what's really lacking in the fossil evidence and also in the genetic evidence. And there's one thing, Kevin, I'd like to get across if I could in the short time remaining, is that for your listeners in Arizona, I'm going to be giving some lectures this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, in Sedona, Prescott, and Tucson, and the information about that can be found on my website, mcremo.com, in the schedule section, mcremo.com, in the schedule section.
And folks, as always, if you click Michael's picture on my website, it will take you to his website as well.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. And Kevin in Beaverton, thank you so much for the call. You're going to be in Sedona on the 5th?
I'm going to be in Sedona on the 5th, that's correct, and in Prescott on the 6th, and Tucson on the 7th. And the information about those events, I'll be talking about my book, Human Devolution. That information can be found on my website.
All right, outstanding. Now, you've got another book in the works as well, don't you?
Well, yes. Later this year, a book I'm titling The Forbidden Archaeologist will be coming out. It's made up of about 50 columns that I've published in Atlantis Rising magazine about my work. So all those are being collected and released in this book, The Forbidden Archaeologist, which will be coming out later this year.
Are any of your books available on this new Kindle technology?
Not yet. We're working on that. There are several things that have to be worked out from a business perspective with my publisher and distributors and Kindle.
Yeah, I was just talking with Walter Bosley today, who is a publisher. And he was telling me that he's got three titles up on Kindle now and was telling me I need to get some of my stuff on Kindle. It's new technology, and apparently lots of people out there have these Kindle book readers.
I have one on my computer. I'm very eager to have my works on there. There are just some things that have to be worked out.
Okay. All right, Michael, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Do you have time to take one more call?
Oh, I do, certainly.
All right. We have time for one quick call. Even though I said this would be our last call, I'm sorry, folks, I lied to you, but I didn't mean to. Caller, your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, appreciate it, Kevin. It's Terry from Ohio.
Hi, Terry.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your guest, because Jerry Wells is kind of big on portholes, and I was reading his page and stuff, and, you know, he talked about a
porthole. You got to make it quick.
Yeah, for Little Bear Ruins. Does he feel that that's still something active? and, you know, what could he, you know, quickly tell me about it?
Okay.
And thanks for the show.
All right.
Well, if I understood Terry, you know, he's talking about portals,
mm-hmm.
which, if I'm understanding him correctly, his use of the word, it appears to be, you know, like some portal of communication between different dimensions or different parts of reality. If that's what he's talking about, I do accept that. I do believe that, yes.
Okay. Well, as a matter of fact, that's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow night. Apparently, at least the reports out on the internet are that such a portal has opened up just off the coast of Yemen. It's allegedly massive, allegedly has warships all around it from several nations. And when Dick Criswell was on with us, he said that he asked his source, which is a three-star general, and that the three-star general told him, yes, it's true. We're going to talk about it tomorrow night. You don't want to miss that. All right, Michael Cremo, thanks for being with us. Stay on the line with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap for this evening. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. And you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.